The next week of classes was the abbreviated one preceding the short Thanksgiving vacation. Most of the Institute's students, not being from Earth, didn't really understand the motive behind the Thanksgiving holiday. Oh, the concept was easy enough to grasp and noble enough. A day to gather one's friends and or family and give thanks for all the things that were going right. But why was it on the fourth Thursday in November, particularly? And what was the deal with the turkey? Nobody complained about having a couple of extra days off in the middle of B-term, though. Some even went home, those whose families lived near enough by to make it worth the trip. None of the duelists nor their inner circle did, though, and on this particular Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, they were all present for the first major snowstorm to hit the DSM campus. And it was a big one, too. It was fairly warm for a snowstorm day, not far below freezing, and there was very little wind. The snow just came straight down, big, heavy, wet flakes, and blanketed the campus, the forest, and Port Gerardar in detail-erasing white. It was the kind of snowstorm that muffled sound and made one feel as though the world itself were shrinking, each person in his own little universe as he slogged through the deepening snow on whatever errand drew him outside on such a day. Clarissa Broadbank was in just such a little universe as she struggled across campus from Hopkins Hall, the physics building, back to Hamlin. She cursed Professor Michalewski. "Oh, Miss Broadbank, if you're not leaving for the holiday, that gives you a chance to make up the lab you failed." And the stupid schoolmates of hers, whom she could see dimly through the curtain of white, out and apparently enjoying the day around her. The first person to hit her with a misdirected snowball was going to pay, and paid dearly. All she wanted to do was get back to her dorm, take off her boots, and read Daddy's robot secretary an excerpt from the Riot Act for stranding her in this godforsaken place over the holiday. Insulated by the snowstorm's world-shrinking effect and her own preoccupation, she completely failed to notice the gray-cloaked figure standing in the middle of the common until she'd collided heavily with it, rebounded, and plopped down on her back in the snow.
"Ah!" Clarissa snarled. "Idiot! Why can't you watch where you're standing?"
The figure, shrouded head to toe in a heavy gray hooded cloak, stood looking impassively down at Clarissa for a few moments. At least, Clarissa thought it was looking at her. It was hard to tell with no visible face. Then it chuckled softly and walked past her and away. Grumbling, Clarissa struggled to her feet, brushed herself off, and made a mental note to extend the Riot Act excerpt. The cloaked figure walked up the hill to the castle and stopped in its front court, looking around at the damaged battlements and snow walls left behind from a recently completed inter-duelist snowball war, the heavy falling snow already obscuring the traces of what must surely have been an epic struggle. With a satisfied nod, it stepped up the stone stairs, unceremoniously thrust the doors open, and barged into the entrance hall. A short gust of wind swirled wet snowflakes around the stranger in the cloak, making it ruffle, before the doors shut with a bang and cut it off. There was no one in here, but from the archway leading to the main dueling hall, the sounds of clashing steel and conversation could be heard, so the figure stamped the snow from its boots and proceeded through the arch. On the main dueling floor, several pairs of duelists were scattered here and there. No actual duels were in progress, only sparring matches and technique demonstrations. Near the middle of the far wall, Caitlin and Utna were sparring, Kate's Zatoichi sheathed, the edge of the Thorn of the Rose covered, while Juri Arisugawa and Miki Kaworu sat with their backs against the wall and watched. The figure made straight for them, stopping at a safe distance. It took Utna and Kate, occupied as they were, a moment to realize that they were being watched by an interloper. When they did, they stopped sparring, bowed reflexively to each other, and turned to face the figure in the cloak as Juri and Miki got to their feet and curiously approached. An arm emerged from the cloak, a gauntleted hand holding an exquisite rose of worked metal. It looked like gold. With a negligent gesture, the figure tossed the rose to the floor at Juri's feet. "It would seem my destiny was not to find Dottori Academy on the rim," said the stranger in a soft, husky, faintly amused murmur. "So I shall have to content myself by asking you to fall for the same trick twice, even if it's not fate's."
Juri picked it up, weighed it in her hand with a thoughtful look, and then smiled. She passed the rose to Utrina, then collected her sword.
"I accept," she answered. "Let's see if your technique has improved, Liza."
The figure doffed her cloak as everyone, except Juri, who began stretching slowly, stared at her. Her long blonde hair was pulled tightly back from her head into a golden braid, woven through with royal blue and royal purple ribbons that escaped from the braid at artistically placed intervals. Painted, or tattooed, on her right cheek, just beneath one beautiful blue eye, was a vivid purple lightning bolt, arching across her right cheekbone and ending just before reaching her ear. Silver chains dangled from an ear cuff and ended in red crystals. She wore a purple silk shirt, with the full blousy sleeves and pointed collar that made it scream, "Swashbuckler!" to every viewer. Black leather fencing gauntlets, skin tight with red chevrons on the back, covered the cuffs. A red long vest, with what looked like some sort of rank insignia on the shoulder, of heavyweight work fabric, but woven with black block spirals around the hem, neck, and shoulders, further accented the atmosphere of piracy. A double-wrapped black leather belt with a silver buckle worked in the shape of a dragon held a pair of swords, one short, one long, both with gray leather-wrapped hilts at her left hip. Her black trousers had red block spirals down the outer seams, and were tucked into calf-high, heeled purple boots with folded tops and black and silver accents. Tucked into the top of her right boot, just visible, was a dagger hilt wrapped in gray to match the swords. Utrina looked from the rose in her hand to the girl who had brought it in blank astonishment, then blurted, "Liza?" Belana Torres and Mia Ausa trotted over from where they had been stretching, Mia astonished, Belana curious. "Liza who?" Belana wanted to know. "Broadbank," Mia told her. "Clarissa's sister." Belana looked confused. "The one who died?" Liza laughed. "In a manner of speaking," she said cheerfully. Then she drew the longer of her two swords, a golden blade which seemed to have about half katana and half scimitar in its lineage, and bowed with a flourish of her blade. "Elizabeth Artas Shustal, late of the Ishkarat trading vessel Dashivuam, at your service."
"Elizabeth Wah?" said Utrina.
"I'll tell you all about it later," Liza promised her with a grinning wink. "Right now, I have business with the redhead."
Corwin parked his griffin in the visitor's lot, at least, he thought it was the visitor's lot, and clambered out into the snow, shoving the door shut behind him.
"Ah," said Nall delightedly from the collar notch of Corwin's heavy black wool overcoat. "What a beautiful day."
Corwin would have given the dragon a funny look, but A, he was used to Nall making pronouncements like that, and B, it's awfully hard to give any sort of a look to someone who's tucked into the front of one's own coat, since it puts his face below one's chin. Instead, he stuck his hands in his pockets and slogged up to the castle. There was nobody in the entrance hall, but the fast-filling tracks he'd seen approaching the doors and the melting snow on the mat indicated that someone had entered recently. Through the archway to the main hall, he could hear what sounded like a duel in progress, and a lot of cheering. Corwin grinned and trotted up one side of the grand double stairs, then through the doors at the top into the dueling hall's second-floor observation gallery. Most of the Duelist Society was there, leaning over the rail and watching avidly, as Juri Arisugawa and a garishly garbed, blonde-plated figure Corwin didn't immediately recognize had at it, while Kate, Miki, and Utrina stood off to one side down below and watched. Utrina noticed the dark smudge of Corwin's overcoat in her peripheral vision, looked up and waved cheerfully to him, then returned her attention to the duel. Corwin unbuttoned his coat and slipped it off, Nall moving to his shoulder in the process, hanging it over his arm, then leaned against the rail and tried to figure out who Jury was fighting. Whoever she was good. She fought in an unorthodox style that looked a little like fencing, a little like kendo, and a little like the way the Society's one Scrang member fought, with a lot of theatrical flourishes and Errol Flynnery. Jury's rather formal style, though it had acquired a certain flair from her periodic trading of notes with Skye, looked very regimented and plain next to her opponent's wild flamboyance. Given such a disparity in style, it was hard to tell just by looking who was winning. The blonde was familiar-looking, though, and her voice struck Corwin as familiar, too, since as she fought she peppered her lunges and ripostes with appreciative little exclamations and encouraging comments, as though she were cheering on her own opponent. Still, he couldn't put his finger on it. She wasn't any of the Valkyrie, he thought for a moment one of them might have stopped in, nor any of the warriors of Frey Lightwalker's Capital Defense Forces. She wasn't anyone he recognized from his father's bewildering bevy of old friends and acquaintances. But he couldn't help but feel that he'd seen her, and heard her voice, somewhere before. "Hey!" said Nall, in a voice unintentionally louder than he'd meant it to be. "Isn't that Liza Broadbitch?" Down below, the blonde heard. She caught Jury's next thrust, twisted away from it, and called gaily up to the gallery, "Not anymore!" before pressing a sizzling counterattack. The fight ranged from one side of the room to the other and all around, using every bit of space available. A couple of times, Miki, Utrina, and Kate had to slide out of the way as the clash unexpectedly barreled in their direction. Neither combatant backed down, slowed up, or faltered until the very, very end. When, in a ringing clash of steel, both roses scattered to the floor, ending the duel in a draw. "Well," said Liza, slightly out of breath, as she returned her sword to its scabbard and bowed in a grandiose way. "That's 50% better than I did the last time. Most satisfactory." Jury gave her a mildly sardonic look and a very small smile. "Your technique is even sloppier now," she told the beaming blonde, "but your spirit is much improved." "Ah, well, before I was only playing at a hatchling's sword game," Liza replied. "This time you faced a swordmaster of the First Circle." Jury Arisugawa rarely looked impressed, even when she was, but now she did, if only slightly. She nodded, acknowledging the achievement. She'd spent enough time discussing the Barsavian swordmaster discipline with Skye to understand what it represented. Then she turned and handed her sword to Miki, who, following a routine ingrained through years of fencing together, had trotted up with a towel in hand to make the usual exchange. "Where's Skye?" Utrina wondered. "He has to see this." As it happened, the Scrang in question, Skye of Orikoshiga Ar Ixtixtakitlt Klvryhelt Ishkarat, had missed the whole thing, because he was up in his room on the fourth floor painting. The castle's stone floors and walls made it impossible to hear what was going on in the main dueling hall from anywhere not connected to that hall by open air. Even the bedrooms directly above parts of the hall, like Mia and Belana's, were dead quiet when there was a fight raging in the hall. Not that the duelists' internal clashes ever really raged, but... So Skye was entirely unaware that anything in particular was going on down in the dueling hall, and even if he had been, he would probably have passed it off as a standard internal thing. After all, on a day like this, they were unlikely to be getting visitors from the outside. He had just put the finishing touches on the painting he'd spent the last week or so working on, when there came a knock at his door. He stepped back from the canvas, surveyed his work, then nodded with satisfaction and went to the door. Mia Ausa was there, smiling. She smiled a little wider at the sight of him. She'd roomed with Skye for a couple of months back in Galaxy House, and the sight of the gas-flame blue Scrang in his smock and beret, smeared here and there with different colors of paint, never failed to amuse her. Not least because a pteranodon-faced, crest-headed Scrang wearing a beret is always an entertaining sight.
Ah, hello, Mia. What brings you by?
Well, Oh, is that your new painting? Sky, it's lovely.
You think so? Sky turned and surveyed the canvas with a self-critical eye. It was a painting of Liza Broadbank, as she had appeared just before she left for her summer aboard the Scrang trading ship Spirit of the River. The likeness was startling, for Sky hadn't left anything out, hadn't glossed over anything for the sake of making it a better portrait. The lovely, regular lines of her face were there, and the clear blue of her eyes, painstakingly matched from the Scrang's extremely good visual memory. Her great mane of very curly blonde hair, cascading down over her slim shoulders, had been rendered with loving detail. But the hollows in her cheeks, the nervous, haunted air of those eyes, and the dark circles around them, he'd depicted all of those, too, exactly as he'd seen them. It was a portrait of a young woman who was on the brink of a great change, and who had almost been smashed to pieces getting there. There was fear in it, but also hope. Pain, but also the anticipation of pleasure. Mia thought it was quite moving, all the more so because Sky had clearly painted it as an elegy to the friend he thought he'd made and then lost so quickly. She smiled all the more, waiting while he got into some better clothes. Scrang having no nudity taboo, nor any particular reason for one. She didn't have to leave for that. It was the main reason they'd been allowed to room together the year before. And then led him down to the library. There, Liza sat in the big blue velvet wingback next to the roaring fire, her hair down from its braid and cascading in its familiar riot of little curls, regaling a semicircle of raptly attentive listeners, which included Miki, Juri, Belana, Wakaba Shinohara, and Dorothy Wainwright, with a story that seemed to have something to do with the theft of a large gemstone from a hot crime boss. Sky froze in the doorway as he caught sight of her, his red-rimmed black eyes going wide, and just stared at her for a moment, his long, pointed jaw agape, the tip of his thick, mobile tail pattering excitedly against the floor. Then he burst out, "Elizabeth!" in a voice that made almost everyone jump. Liza glanced up, grinned, then got to her feet and covered the space between them in two great bounds, before catching the Scrang up in an embrace that probably would have bowled him over backward if not for his tail. "Yatai Kiapas, Skaya, you tail-stealing pirate!" she declared, sounding absolutely delighted with herself. She planted a big kiss on his snout, which he didn't really know how to take, then dragged him over to the couch and plunked him down. "You're just in time for the really good part." "Good part of what?" asked Kyuichi Sayanji as he entered the room, still brushing snow from his coat. He'd been outside shoveling the side paths. That was rather pointless, since it was still snowing like the dickens, but Caitlin-sensei told him to go shovel the side paths, and so he went and shoveled the side paths. In a couple of hours, he would probably do it again. Such was the life of a kenjutsu novice. Sayanji was content. A moment later, he was getting his own whirlwind hug and big deep kiss, brief but, as firefighters like to say, fully involved, from Liza, which left him with rather wide eyes and elicited an indignant, "Hey!" from Wakaba. "Hm?" said Liza, releasing the green-haired duelist and turning to Wakaba. "Oh, I'm sorry," she said, and then grabbed Wakaba up in her arms and gave her a big kiss as well. "Gah!" said Wakaba, stumbling back a bit. "That's not what I meant." Liza smiled sweetly. "You don't mind when Tenjo does it," she said. "I never did it that enthusiastically," put in Utena Riley. "I can teach you," said Liza encouragingly. "Pass, thanks," said Utena. "Your loss," Liza replied with a breezy shrug. Wakaba, unable to speak, just stood there and sputtered, making sharp, percussive little noises that might have been the beginnings of actual words, but were too compressed to come out that way. "Oh, now you've done it," said Sayonji dryly. "She can't even speak." "It's actually kind of restful," said Utena, and then, "Ow!" as Wakaba kicked her in the ankle.
A moment later, the library door opened again, and as Lynn Devere Natashkin walked in, looking rather snow-encrusted, she'd been out for a walk, and there was still unmelted snow caught in her thick, wiry gray hair. Her coppery cheeks were faintly darkened with the chill of the outside air. "Hello, everyone," she said cheerily. "It's a beautiful day outside, almost like being back on Dantrov. I..." Just what she would never be determined, because before she got any farther, Liza had swooped down upon her, fast enough that she didn't get a good look before the blonde was too close to see. As Alin's eyes went wide, then half-hooded, she didn't know who was kissing her, but whoever it was, they were doing a good job, so what the hell? When in Rome and all that. The scent was familiar, but her nose, numbed a bit from the cold air, couldn't quite make it out. She was warming up in a hurry with this kind of motivation, though. She had just been thinking about how her lips were cold and wondering who, inside the castle, she might sneak a kiss from to warm them up. Then it hit her where she'd smelled that scent before. It was different, subtly but definitely so, but there could be little doubt about it. As Alin struggled a bit in the arms that held her, pushed herself back, and focused on the face of her osculator, her golden eyes went wide with surprise, again, blinking once, as a ruddy-cheeked, tattooed Liza Broadbank grinned back at her. The stunned Dantrovian opened her mouth to say something, probably Liza's name in an astonished tone of voice, but Liza occupied it again, and she couldn't say anything more for some time. The duelists looked at each other with varying degrees of discomfort, except for Miki, who was looking at his stopwatch with a little piper's smile, and Dorothy, who didn't seem to care one way or the other. And most of them were starting to slip out of the room when the door opened again and Beldandy came cheerily in, a kitchen apron tied on over her sweater and bell skirt. "Utna, dear, we should..." The goddess paused, seeing that she'd nearly walked smack into a quite involved pair of kissers. Some of the people present who didn't know Belle terribly well winced, expecting her to be upset or embarrassed. But she merely smiled benevolently and said, "Oh, I see we have another guest. Well, that's all right. Plenty for everyone. We should really get started if we want to have dinner ready at 7, she finished, turning back to Utna.
Yeah, said Utna, nodding. "Good idea."
She sidled past Azalin and Liza and out into the hall, gratefully following Beldandy to the kitchen.
"You know, Aunt Belle," she said, "you would think I'd have gotten used to having surreal days by now."
Belle smiled mildly and replied,
"You're young yet, dear. My Keiichi can give you some tips if you'd like."
"Every little bit helps," said Utna wryly. Back in the library, Liza finally released Azalin and returned to her chair, grinning from ear to ear. Azalin fumbled for words, blushing in a most un-Azalin-like fashion for several seconds, then burst out all at once,
"Wow! Where'd you learn to kiss like that?"
Liza smiled enigmatically and said airily,
"Ah, Azalin, that's a story for a smaller crowd."
For the next several hours, Utna and Beldandy barricaded themselves into the castle's kitchen, did not emerge, and allowed no one else entry. It was critical that inveterate moochers like Nall and Azalin be kept out. It was more critical that people like Corwin and Caitlin, who would try to help, be kept out. While the self-appointed cooks toiled, Professor Ravenhair arrived, house guide Erd came down from her aerie in the South Tower, and the two of them set the great long table in the castle's rarely used formal dining room for the Thanksgiving feast. As they worked, Skuld confided to Erd in a quiet undertone that she was very worried about poor Vigdis Brightblade. The girl had flatly refused to join her mentor at the castle's first Thanksgiving, instead choosing to exercise her option, since school was out, to return to Asgard and spend the afternoon with the rest of the Valkyrie.
"All this past week she's been in a funk," Skuld murmured. "Stays in her room when she's not due in class or helping me. I'm afraid this surface world assignment just isn't working out for her. But she wanted it so badly, I hate to call it a failure so soon and send her back." Erd shrugged. Maybe she's hung up on some guy, she said.
You always think everyone's problems have something to do with sex, Skuld grumbled.
Newsflash, sis. Most of them do.
Skuld sighed. Figdis is too young to be having that kind of problem yet.
Oh? Like you were?
Skuld glanced up from arranging a plate at the head of the table and fixed her sister with a look.
What's that supposed to mean? She asked.
Erd smiled.
Just this. Corwin may have been born in 2391, but he was an idea a long time before that.
Skuld gazed at Erd for a few silent seconds, then sighed, conceding the point, and went back to setting the table.
Well, I'll talk to her after the holidays, she said after a few more moments. We'll go back to Asgard for New Year's, and I'll sit her down and have a long talk with her then. I guess I'd better, she added, giving Erd a wry grin, before you take it into your head to do it.
Erd said nothing. She just went on putting down forks and knives. Not until she was clear at the other end of the table, well out of Skuld's earshot, did she murmur to herself,
Under the circumstances, I don't think I could.
Thanksgiving dinner at the Duelist's castle was a rousing success. At 6 that evening, Amanda Dessler, Rena Dragonar, and, most welcome surprise for all, Devlin Carter beamed down from Amanda's personal starship, the Lorica. There was an awkward moment when Amanda and Liza found themselves confronted with each other, but only a moment, as Liza went far too easily now to keep it that way. Amanda looked Liza up and down, taking in her different clothing, her new bearing, and the formerly absent sparkle in her eyes, and smiled, saying only, Interesting. Rena and Liza circled each other like sharks for a couple of minutes. Rena had heard all about how Liza had nearly gotten Amanda and Devlin, the two most important people to her in all creation, killed back in May, and she wasn't therefore inclined to be pals with the blonde now. On the other hand, Amanda seemed to be satisfied with her, and Devlin had forgiven her before they'd gone their separate ways, she to the Skrang fleet, he to the International Police Organization's Psionics Academy on far-flung Jirai. He greeted her now quite cordially, gave her a flower that he'd plucked out of nowhere, and seemed genuinely pleased with the changes in her. So Rena eventually let her suspicious attitude drop and allowed herself to be pulled into the general flow of things. Liza, who'd only been on the defensive because Rena looked like she might want to start something, relaxed immediately. She wasn't interested in another fight today. At 7, then, the society, most of their closest friends, the Norns, Janice Barlow, and a couple of random classmates who had been trapped here over the holiday break, sat down at the long table, which could easily have held at least 10 more, and feasted on turkey with all the usual trimmings. Table service was provided by a cheery Beldandi, she wouldn't let Utena help, shooing the pink-haired duelist to her seat between Caitlin and Corwin, with the assistance of her elder sister and two small robots in extremely comical bow ties and aprons. Compliments and toasts flew round the table, most of them welcoming Liza back to the land of the living and wondering where she'd been all this time. She declined to tell that story, saying that it would be rude to monopolize the dinner conversation so completely. She was, after all, a guest. Instead, while some of the duelists stewed in an agony of wondering, she graciously yielded the floor to the others. Devlin told them about his first semester at the Psionics Academy, drawing near to a close now. He couldn't really go into much detail on the training itself. It would have been kind of hard to follow for anyone but another telepath, which only Liza was, and parts were classified. Still, there were some funny stories from his training days, like the time he and three classmates almost burned down the chemistry lab. But what we didn't know, none of us, was that Crichton was pyrokinetic. And Devlin generally looked happier than he had in years. After dinner, Skuld saw the guests from other dorms back safe to their beds with the aid of a whimsical device she referred to as
Snow Sentry Banpei RX-17, then returned to spend the night in one of the castle's spare rooms, as Bell was also doing. The duelists and their overnight guests then installed themselves in the library. Corwin stoked up the fire, Aunt Bell brought them all hot cocoa, and they all burrowed into the couches and chairs under blankets and quilts, while the snow still came down outside the tall, narrow windows. Once everyone was comfortable, Liza sat up straight in the wingback chair she'd claimed and told her story. It was a long one, and it took Liza most of the night to tell it, but she made the telling a good one. She did voices, she did sound effects. She got up and reenacted, sometimes with Sky's bemused but game assistance, some of the best parts. The whole thing was so wild that some of the duelists found themselves wondering how much of it was strictly true and how much the storyteller's embellishment. Still, she'd gotten those swords, those clothes, that new attitude, and those tattoos. My, but that was an odd place to have the alchemical symbol for Mercury installed on one's person. Someplace. And the tale she told to account for herself from June to November certainly covered enough ground to account for them all. She told them of the months before the ship's destruction, for she had been destroyed, the noble Da Shivuam, but not without a fight, oh no. The drudgery, the back-breaking labor, the surliness and constant complaints of her Kaiser-ridden bunkmates. For the first week she'd cried every night, certain that her eagerness to undertake this was a mistake. Certain that if the work didn't kill her, the isolation would. These creatures were so alien, and she had never been so alone. But then she realized, with the aid of her emerging empathic talents, that the Skrang weren't really so different. Oh, physiologically they were, certainly. Liza didn't have a tail, nor a crest, nor could she breathe underwater for fairly extended periods. At first she felt as strange to them as they were to her, but once she stopped crying and started talking to them, she realized that wasn't the case. There were humans on Barsave, the Outer Rim world whence the Skrang came. Indigenous humans, one more example of the remarkable parallel evolution that had made Earth people, Corellians, Zardons, and several other independently evolved races all but identical. And there were other races, too, in all 9 different and separate races of what Barsavians called name-givers, sentient beings, living and working together on that remote but resource-rich world. To Liza's crewmates, it was odd that a human should choose to become a Camoro, literally deck scrubber, the low, menial position traditionally held by Skrang in Kaisa, but not disturbing, just strange. The first real human connection she'd made with the Skrang aboard the Spirit of the River wasn't with one of the crew, though, but with a passenger, a traveling follower of the Swordmaster discipline. Like Skaya, and yet how unlike Sky had she been, who was more worldly by far than the Ishkarat crew. Fathaka Mindlina Antoine Jezebel Urtas Jakalarash was, by Liza's account, which was the only one the duelists were likely to get, a remarkable individual, even for a Skrangish swordmaster. In Liza's limited off-duty time, she'd slowly befriended the ship's lone, mysterious passenger over the course of their long slog to the Outer Rim, which had occupied most of June, what with all the stops they had to make. Then the ship had suffered drive problems, and when they'd reached Barsave, Captain Ariane had chosen to put it in for repairs. The Camoro had been reassigned to other ships, continued labor being critical to distract the sufferers in Kaisa, except for Liza, who was given permission to go with Fathaka and assist her with an errand. That errand had turned out to be the aforementioned theft of a hut crime boss's biggest gem. This was a complex and dangerous operation, made more complex and more dangerous by Fathaka's rather curious idea of what constituted a proper theft, and it occupied 2 weeks. The two barely made it back to the Spirit in time for her departure from Barsave, by which time Liza had become Fathaka's apprentice in the Swordmaster discipline. More than that, she was also learning Fathaka's rather unique take on all the Skrang philosophy, and anyone who had spent any significant time around Skaya could tell you that the Skrang had a lot of philosophy. The rest of July and all of August were, then, even harder work than June had been, for now, in addition to her duties as a Komoro, Liza had her training as a swordmaster to attend to. And yet, in the face of such adversity, she not only bore up, she flourished. When she and Fathaka parted on Cardassia Prime, Liza didn't know what her teacher was doing there and didn't want to. Liza left as a swordmaster of the First Circle, reinvented, retooled, clear-headed, in the best shape of her life, and ready to take on the whole galaxy if need be. She'd even changed her name, Shustal, for the Scrang expression meaning nothing more need be said, from which had been derived her crewmate's joking nickname for her, Lyshustai, Liza says little. Among Scrang, the joke went, Liza was the taciturn one. Ertas from her mentor and the architect of her rebirth. Elizabeth was a fine old name, her grandmother's name, and her grandmother had never been part of the family politics. So she kept that to honor Grandma, and all the rest went in the dustbin with yesterday's hatreds. And then, on the very morning of her anticipated triumphant return to Gerardo, disaster had struck Liza. She had been working in the after-cargo hold at the time, and never had managed to learn what the hell had happened in detail. But someone, some pirate force, had attacked the Spirit of the River, crippling her engines with a lucky shot, overwhelming her shields and boarding her. Liza and the rest of her cargo bay crewmates had found themselves suddenly locked in desperate combat with a ragtag gang of humans, Malons, and assorted other humanoid riffraff, all of them armed with blasters and vibroshivs. They were doing pretty well, too, until the Spirit started to break up. In the desperate scramble that followed, Liza had found herself in a leadership role, mainly because nobody else had bothered. She and the survivors from her cargo crew had linked up with survivors from the engine room and other areas of the ship and fought their way to the lifeboats. From there, it had been a wild ride to the surface of the nearest Class M planet, a charted but ignored wilderness world on the fringe of the Federation, unclaimed by any of the Federation's sub-polities, devoid even of a useful name. The next 2 months had been spent living wild on the beautiful but harsh planet. The survivors of the Spirit's crew were scattered all over one hemisphere by the shower of lifeboats and escape pods that had heralded their vessel's destruction. Some of the pirates had come down as well, and their mates, while hauling away what remained of the Spirit, didn't come looking for them. Abandoned, they banded into gangs, and, rather than try and survive on their own, had sought out the Scrang and tried to take their supplies. September and October were thus occupied mainly by an effort to link up and gather together all the scattered Spirit survivors and forge them into a force that could successfully oppose the stranded pirates, which was done, and done gloriously, on Halloween. Some of the surviving pirates joined Liza's crew. They were Liza's crew now. The officers all down with the ship were captured by the pirates, no one knew for sure, and set about looking for a way off the planet. No one was liable to come looking for them. They were a long way from where the battle had taken place, and this world didn't even appear on most charts, including those of the Ishkarat Trading House. However, as luck would have it, they'd discovered that there was someone already there. Someone with spaceflight capabilities in place. Someone who hadn't the faintest inkling of the guerrilla war that had been happening on the planet, right next door to their hiding place. Someone who wasn't supposed to be here. The Cardassian Obsidian Order had established a secret base on this planet within Federation space, and they were aiming enormous passive sensors at Babylon 5 from its unmolested vantage point.